Hello, and welcome to a pandemic podcast. Today, we're going to be looking at a year in review, the year of 2022. We saw a lot happen, and let's chat about it. This is going to be part one of two. This episode, we're going to be looking more on January, February, and March, how the groundwork was set. And then in part two of two, we will be looking at the later part of 2022 and how that brings us into this current point where we are at. There has been a lot of things that have happened. We have seen protections be lifted in New Brunswick, Atlantic Canada, and across the country. We have seen illness, disability, and death rates rise in New Brunswick, Atlantic Canada, and across the country. And we've seen mounting evidence and research and knowledge and education increase. And we know so much more now in January 2023 than we did last year. And yet we have so fewer, and in some places, no universal protections in place to help us protect us from this ongoing airborne disease. Whew. So just some light topics for today. Basically, what we're going to be doing today is we're going to be going through each month and looking back and seeing what happened and kind of how that leads us to where we're at today. We are joined with Kay and Chris, and let's dive in. Chris, where are we at?
So if we start back at the beginning of 2022, it was quite a different landscape than it is now, definitely. We had just gone into the Christmas holiday with the introduction of the Omicron variant on our shores and in our province and across the country. It was quite a challenging time for the government and for people looking to the government for information. And what we saw was a bit of panic on both parties' count, some scrambling to get things in place. We went into January with the announcement that we were going to be moving to level three of the winter plan. This was a new plan developed by GNB to address COVID mandates. And level three was the most restrictive of those levels. Basically, people had to stay within their single household bubble. We had to limit public gatherings. They were basically not permitted. Gyms and indoor recreation places like that were not allowed to even operate. Restaurants were not allowed to have in-restaurant dining. It was only takeout, drive-through, or delivery. Retail businesses were limited to how many people they could have in their business. Churches were allowed to do indoor services. Sports activities were closed. So, and we still had, of course, the mask mandate in place. Now, this was all predicated on a number of cases that had come up in the province, as well as the modeling that had been done for the province, which showed a dramatic increase in hospitalizations and possibly deaths were we not to put in mandated protections. During one of the press conferences, the government announced that we'd be moving into this level three, and that occurred on January 14th. Simultaneously, they also stated that kids would not be going back to in-person class, and they'd have at least 2 weeks to be doing remote schooling. It's in stark contrast to what we see nowadays with similar case level, similar hospitalization, even more hospitalization now than was occurring at the time.
Wow.
And it was really the last time we saw that kind of move from the government. They were trying to get out in front of it, at least on the surface, that's what it appeared to be. And they were making unpopular calls to stem the surge in the Omicron variant. So you have sort of a contextual idea of what that looks like then compared to now. We don't have January numbers right now because they're lagging so badly currently with the updates. But at the end of December, this move to the level three was based on 42 people in hospital with or for COVID. They hadn't switched those out yet. They were reporting both with or for 42 people in hospital, 14 in ICU. So that's pretty high ICU number. But we know now that that's not a very high hospital number. In fact, in the same time, at the end of December 2022, we had 136 people in hospital with or for COVID and 11 people in the ICU. So looking at that December 2021 to December 2020, it's pretty remarkable how different the response is compared to what is actually, you know, a, probably a more severe situation for the public.
A couple things that, so just for listeners, is that when it came to the different things that you noted of places being closed or different restrictions, as we know, each province kind of handles those differently. So the ones that you had listed were ones specific for New Brunswick. And one of the things that you had mentioned were the churches. And that was one that I was following closely because there was a church in my area that was going against those requirements. And my understanding was that churches were always allowed to be open. It's just they had to do so safely. So either by having masks or operating under certain conditions, but there was one church in specific that was operating under none of those safety conditions, and that was causing quite a stir in the area. So just for listeners to note, like, churches were never closed if they were operating safely for people to visit.
Right.
Does that sound about right?
That's how I remember it too. Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
They were perfectly within their right to hold outdoor services, I believe, like drive-in services and things like that. And I think it was not too long after this initial switch to the level three, everything went out the window in very quick succession. And it was not too long after that that they were allowed to have services indoors, provided they had a COVID plan and masking and those kind of things.
Yes. So just to let people know that, like, churches were never said you cannot hold service ever. So
yeah. I think they
we did have different safety measures in place, but it was never a quote unquote lockdown. Okay, thoughts.
This is something we'll have to just check on, because I do think that in-person services were suspended at some point. I think that you would have always been allowed to go and meet with your, you know, your pastor or equivalent. But I do think there was a period of time.
They could always do the drive-in. They could do the drive-in stuff, the outdoor drive-ins.
Yeah.
I've got the indoors.
I think they couldn't, right?
I think so. Yeah. The level three, I've got that in front of me here. The level three states that faith venues may provide outdoor, virtual, or in-car religious services only.
Okay.
Yeah. But you're right. They weren't prevented from doing services. They had to do them in a specific manner. Yeah.
So I guess I'm just thinking, because I know I've seen a lot of rhetoric from folks being like, oh my goodness, you didn't let us do this. And it's like, well, hold on a minute.
There were options. Anyways, there were definitely options. Yeah.
Totally, like, a very random tangent there. But now, leading to that, though, something that did happen in January as well, actually, I think this is kind of the perfect segue, is we saw a lot of increasing rhetoric around a quote unquote freedom convoy. That was something unique in Canada. They started to travel from across the country. Different folks who were advocating for quote unquote freedom were driving to Ottawa with large honking vehicles. And they were planning to meet there at the end of January because they did not want to have any more restrictions, quote unquote, restrictions. So that was also something that was happening in the air.
Yeah. What led to this was in the later days of 2021, when vaccination mandates came in at a federal level, they had announced that they were going to mandate vaccination for cross-border trucking companies and drivers. And there was a grace period in place for people to obtain their vaccinations. And we know that about 80 to 90% of truck drivers went and got their vaccinations, no questions asked. They didn't really care too much one way or the other. But that exemption period for unvaccinated cross-border truckers ended on January 15th. The rumblings had started before that about the Freedom Convoy and a protest at Parliament Hill. only a few days after that, maybe a week after that, that the convoy got enough semblance of organization to actually get on the road from British Columbia and head toward Ottawa. They wouldn't actually reach Ottawa for, I think it was about a week it took them to get there. But once they did get there, there were some pretty chaotic situations that that happened after that. And we can get into how that played out a little bit in February when we talk about February. But it's important to keep that in mind because Cheryl is right. That was some of the first widespread, particularly in the media, widespread coverage of dissenting rhetoric around the concept of libertarianism and how what was always framed as communal protection at the beginning of the pandemic was now being interpreted by this group and reframed and sold to a larger audience as an infringement on individual freedom.
Wow. Well, hearing you summarize it like that, yeah, I feel like there was kind of a cone of protection in a way from the media around dissent. We didn't often hear much in the mainstream media. I'm sure in the alt-right media that was probably present for a long time. But from our more mainstream media, we weren't hearing much dissent. Up until that point, there seemed to be a lot of effort put into focusing on the collective, focusing on protecting each other, and a lot of cheerleading for public health. You know, we got the stories about the kids dressing up as public health officers for Halloween, right? We got the stories about sending all the cards to the public health officers. So there truly wasn't much platforming of dissent. And I find that holds true today. You seldom see a negative story about the public health response, even though we now know that, for example, public health was getting regular updates from Public Health Agency of Canada about long COVID, and none of them shared the bulk of that information or the most relevant parts of that information. So it's interesting to me that there are extremely legitimate critiques to be made of the provincial and the federal public health response. And yet it's incredibly difficult to get the mainstream media to cover that. Yet there's been a lot of coverage of the convoy adjacent kind of thing, which does the job of promoting some of those individuals, some of those groups. Yeah, it's just, and I don't know what is the solution to that? I don't know. But I think it's worth pointing out that, like, even though you have somebody like Dr. Bonnie Henry in BC coming out and making objectively false statements about masks and about the severity of the virus, it's very difficult to get a story on record criticizing her. There still seems to be an element of protecting the people and the offices that are in place to ostensibly maintain public health. Yet you also get these attacks on protections, on protective measures from the convoy coverage. And it's interesting because they kind of converge at one point, because many of the statements that come from our public health personnel are statements against the value of masks that are unfounded in science, like biased scientifically and physics-wise, engineering-wise, incorrect statements, either emphasizing non-existent harms of masking or downplaying proven effectiveness of masking. These statements are made by our public health officials to the public. And then you also get in the media, angry anti-mask people get quite a lot of airtime. So yeah, it's certainly, I think, something to keep in the back of your mind and to keep as part of the public conversation about this. There is a lot of bias against the utility of masks and the utility of mandates. And the necessity sometimes of mandates. And sometimes we're getting that rhetoric from the convoy, and sometimes we're getting that rhetoric from our very own public health officers.
That's a really good point. Like, and we'll see over the course of the year how this changes. Because at the beginning of the year, people were aghast at the concept of these people. And they still, the convoy, the Freedom Convoy, still has very little support across Canada, generally speaking. But their rhetoric has seeped through the media and into people's minds. And it's become this kind of innocuous little tidbits of information that people take as fact now. And they are reiterated by public health officials. Just like you said, Kay, we get to the point where we have Bonnie Henry outright lying to media and nobody questions her. We have uncovered information in New Brunswick that our chief medical officer of health fabricated evidence of the harms of masking. The public health has covered up the information about long COVID for more than 2 years, and yet nothing comes of it. The Office of Public Health retains this manufactured authority, and we still see politicians who get the odd question about mandates or COVID or what's the situation. They still defer to that authority of public health like it hasn't been shown to be completely fabricated and incompetent in so many ways. The fact that it still exists and is ongoing and is pointed to as a bastion of evidence and scientific rigor is baffling. It's we're not making this up. We're not conspiracy theorists here. We've got this information. It's in black and white, and nobody said anything, to the point where even that rhetoric where it began in January with people going, "Oh my God, what are these people are like, what is this? They don't want any lockdowns. Are they crazy? Like, what's going on?" To the point now where we see 12 months later, at the end of the year, a marginalization of advocates and people working to protect one another, and an outright denial of science, which was for decades just taken for granted. 3 years into the pandemic, and there are media pieces on whether or not N95 masks are effective to control virus spread. It's
oh my God,
it's baffling.
My take would be that in Canada, we do not have a media that is used to fact-checking and questioning officials. Whereas in the United States, we see fact-checkers occurring in real time during presidential debates. But in Canada, there's this quote-unquote politeness of government or this trust in the institution, even when they've been proven to be untrustworthy.
I hear you. And I've had some conversations like back when in March, when the protections were being dropped and when this was still a hot topic in the media, I had a number of over the phone, you know, voice to voice conversations with some of our, you know, members of the media in New Brunswick. And I can just remember one conversation where the person I was speaking to just, I could feel it dawning on them and it really hitting them that the information coming from GMB was not accurate and was not the best quality information. It was not the standard, right? Like that. And there was just this pause and this verbalization. This member of the media said it out loud: "We are going to have to fact check Jennifer Russell, aren't we?" And it was as if that hadn't occurred to them before. And I can honestly relate to that because that's where I started from too. In earlier in 2021, would have been thinking, well, the information coming from the government is correct. And the big thing to watch out for is these anti-vaccine, anti-science people. They're the real threat. You know, they're the real thing that I've got to warn against, right? And keep my friends in the loop and say, okay, don't listen to that stuff. Listen to government in New Brunswick. But over time, as you started to see that the messaging coming from Governor New Brunswick was not matching up with what was coming out of even the published scientific literature, that's when I think a number of us were realizing like, oh gosh, we have to be very critical and on our toes about what's coming from Governor of New Brunswick. But it was, I think, eye-opening to me to get to that point sooner than people who you would hope would have already had their finger on the pulse of the fact that what was being said to the public by our government had already diverged really widely from what was coming out of the publications. And, you know, to get to witness somebody have that realization was a big moment. But what's come of that since? Not very much. And I know that they don't have maybe the personnel or the budget and all that, but at some point, the fact that so many New Brunswickers are dying and that so many New Brunswickers are becoming disabled and getting sick and that our hospitals are no longer able to serve the needs of our population, this has got to once again become a real focus and not a sideshow. This has got to become something that our members of the media really put their weight behind again, because it's that important. So yeah, I completely agree with you.
Want to move to February?
Yeah. Just before we do, I want to get a running tally here with one of the metrics that has been more or less consistent. I'll get into that a little bit later. Throughout the pandemic and throughout this year, I have to acknowledge that deaths caused by COVID are not the only negative outcome, of course. Hospitalizations, ICU visits, and just the impact of a bad COVID infection in general are not easily dismissed. That said, the death toll in New Brunswick is a metric that we have been using to determine sort of the severity and the prevalence of the situation here. We entered the year with a death toll of 160. That was later revised down to 151 in October. But we'll start with that 160 because that's the most consistent number we have. So on January 1st, we were looking at 160 people had succumbed to COVID-19 infection. By the end of January, that had gone up by 78 deaths. That was later revised down a little bit. But by the end of January, we were sitting at 238 people dead due to COVID-19 in New Brunswick. So we go into February. Early on in February, the situation in the federal capital is deteriorating fast. Ottawa declared a state of emergency on February 6th, followed by Ontario-wide state of emergency on February 11th. Soon after that, on the 14th, Prime Minister invoked the Emergencies Act, and that gave the police the authority to move those people out. And the Freedom Convoy came to a fairly quick end. One thing to note about the convoy is on the very first weekend that it arrived at Parliament Hill, they were looking at between 5 and 10,000 people, I think they said, at the end of the day. That quickly dropped to about 3,000 people. And then by the beginning of February, the month that we're talking about now, that was down to about 250 people who were steadily in place, causing a great deal of stress, anxiety, and problems for the people of the capital. Coincidentally, on February 11th, when Trudeau invoked the Emergencies Act, we actually had a small Freedom Convoy visit the legislature in Fredericton, a fairly small crowd under 1,000 people, which petered out over the weekend. Having the foresight due to what they saw in Ottawa, Fredericton police prohibited any large vehicles from entering the downtown core. And basically, we just ended up with a few people who were angry about mandates and angry about masks and felt that their personal freedom had been violated, I guess.
I like your sigh of a...
It's difficult to comprehend having the privilege to consider minor inconveniences more of an impact to your own life or give weight to them to such a degree that it negates impacts on the scale of permanent disability and death to other people in the province you live in. It's something that I struggle with. I think we all struggle with. More frightening is the nudging of the official bodies toward the people of New Brunswick and across the country into that movement away from empathy.
Well, and that's something, though, is that, like you said earlier, the convoy never had a majority of public support. So that's important for listeners to remember. And also, it did have dwindling support of people attending. And also, people didn't know about the long term. Well, so many people right now, a year later, still don't know about the long term disabling effects of COVID, because our government only released information about it after we released a right to information request on it in November.
Isn't that interesting to think about the fact that had the government, both federal, I mean, I know the federal government has had information about long COVID on its website, blah, 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 but it hasn't really emphasized the hazard of long COVID, right? It hasn't paid attention or publicized the hazard to the degree that dealing with it warrants, and mm-hmm. and even more so at the provincial level. So it's kind of sad to think that had our various levels of government been a lot more transparent in real time with the information that the Public Health Agency of Canada was providing them, the reaction of Canadians to this disruption and this domestic terrorism could have been different. Like, yeah. How would it have changed the media coverage of the convoy if what was known already about long COVID in January of 2022 was part of the public discourse, right? Like, exactly. By them hiding the realities of this virus, it certainly has made more space for these uninformed dissenting opinions and movements. Whereas if the information about long COVID was as readily available as other kinds of information and other frequent topics of conversation about COVID, then this would have all seemed so much more ridiculous so much sooner. And people would have had a lot more to stand on in terms of standing up for continued protection. All of the very valid reasons to protect yourself, knowing that the only way to prevent long COVID is to not catch COVID. Or to reduce the number of times you catch COVID in your lifetime at the moment, given that there's no cure for long COVID at the moment. You know, this is the kind of thing that should be as common knowledge as the fact that there ever was a convoy, as common knowledge as any of the horrific personalities involved in promoting the hatred and the division and the anti-science and the ignorance and all that. If only everybody who'd ever heard of some of these people had also heard about just even a handful of the facts about long COVID. So why is that this sensationalist, awful, baseless stuff is what ends up getting media coverage over and over and over again and captures people's attention? And yet the information about long COVID, well, first of all, hasn't captured people's attention because all of the provinces have been trying to hide it.
Mm-hmm.
I have an idea about that, not to rewind, but if we go back into December when Omicron was starting to hit Canada, we see public health across the country already start to put out the rhetoric of it being mild. In a few places, even mentioning the idea that this will be the variant that will get us to endemicity. When data was coming in, particularly in New Brunswick, about the caseload, the hospitalizations, the ICUs, the deaths, even early on in December from Delta and then ramping up from Omicron, we saw them go to the extreme with the winter plan, the level 3 of the winter plan. But they had already announced that at the end of January, on February 1st, we were going to be returning to level 2. So that was already set in stone, regardless of the outcomes of the move to level 3 and those mandated protections, those mandated situations. Higgs had already stated that we would be moving to the next lower tier of protection at the end of the month. And then furthermore, we would be moving to level 1 mid-February.
Mm-hmm.
So these conversations, that's right. And these conversations were already happening. It's almost as if the Freedom Convoy was a gift to these people who were trying to sell this to people, right? They knew that from a economy perspective, they had to get people back to work. They had to get people not isolating. They had to put the pandemic behind them. And they struggled with how to reframe what they had been telling the public for 2 years until a large, angry mob, well, not so large, but an angry mob at the Capitol did it for them. And once the Freedom Convoy packed up and went home, across the country, we see everything dropping. And we see the beginning of that trickle of anti-science rhetoric and false claims about the harms of masking or the harms of lockdown start getting into the vernacular of the public. And actually, as you said, Kay, into the actual talking points of public health. So we went to level
to
1.
To the public.
Yeah.
That was horrific. We had our chief public health officer on the radio talking to worried New Brunswickers, you know, who were facing the return to school with no protections. And we had our chief public health officer only talk about what she called the harms of masking, which were not based in evidence.
No. And still aren't.
Yes, exactly. Because you were talking about how that rhetoric had seeped in and how you're absolutely right to locate the phenomenon of the convoy in what was already decided by our governments. They had pre-decided and they had pre-planned, regardless of what the data was going to show us. In terms of severity, in terms of hospitalizations, you know, they did in New Brunswick make a belated, modest effort to not have everybody get sick at once. And I will mention actually that when you're talking about January, the Department of Health, this is not a publicly available thing, but the Department of Health did have a town hall at the beginning of January with the New Brunswick Medical Society. And so physicians in New Brunswick did have the opportunity to attend a virtual meeting with the Department of Health. And in that meeting, they outlaid what they thought Omicron might do to the healthcare system, what the impacts were going to be, how they were going to handle that in terms of the different staffing levels, whether you were going to be operating at a contingency staffing level, at a crisis staffing level, and the kind of interplay that that had with the sickness, right? So if your particular unit was at a crisis staffing level, then people were going to have to come into work while positive, you know, covering all that kind of thing. And it was really something that they had planned for it. They were talking about having overflow emergency capacity at the biggest hospitals. They were fully planning for there to be a lot of sick people at once and how they were going to handle that. And so this level three, you know, I think was belatedly, obviously it should have come in sooner, but it was belatedly an effort to at least not have everybody get sick at once. But they had their reopening targets, their kind of relaxation of protections targets. They were already decided and they were so quick. They were so fast. It was too fast to actually evaluate if we were in an okay position to move on to the next phase. It was too quick because they were all done within a couple of weeks of each other. It was done so quickly that nobody could raise their hand and say, hey, wait a minute. There was no attempt to control the variables, right? When you do an experiment, you try to only change one variable at a time so that when you get a different outcome, you're able to look and say, I changed that variable. This is the result. You're getting some causation there. But when they moved through dropping the protections again, they did it so quickly. They changed the variables, so many of them at the same time, and they changed them all so quickly that nobody had the opportunity to hit the brakes and say, whoa, you reopened dining and you allowed the resumption of sports tournaments with no protections and you changed this and you just changed that 2 weeks ago. What it all comes down to is increased or decreased contact between people, right? And so that's what we were told right from the very beginning was this is why we're putting these protections in place, because our modeling shows us that as we decrease contact between people by this percent, this is what that is going to do to our rates of illness. And when we had our level three, which was our most restrictive level of protection in the winter plan, and moved down to level two, which was less restrictive, and then level one, which was the least restrictive, every time we jumped a level, that increased people's contacts with each other in a variety of ways, whether that was indoor dining, whether that was sports tournaments, whether that was religious services. And then when you add in on top of that, the fact that there was never any mention that this is an airborne virus and you should be paying attention to higher quality masking and you should be cleaning the air. And then when you immediately after that get the announcement in February that everything was going to be dropped as of March 14th, like they just changed all the variables so fast that there was never any opportunity for an evidence-based objection to the increased hazard that was thrust upon all of us.
Well, and that's where with this convoy nonsense, exactly what y'all are saying, this entire opening up plan was decided in December. And then the convoy happened at the end of January and mid-February. And then somehow their rhetoric has stayed and seeped into the public narrative, even though there was never widespread support for them. In the absence of real information and accurate information.
To Kay's point about there not being time to do an evidence-based assessment, it would be literally impossible. We've been told from the beginning of the pandemic, we see this in the science, that the outcomes of what we do today won't be known for 2 or 3 weeks, because it does take time for those impacts to see change. New Brunswick government said that when they moved to level 3. So the idea that we went down 2 levels successively in a matter of weeks was beyond the scope of any scientific discussion to actually validate. And in fact, once in that time frame when they were moving from level 3 to level 2 to level 1, they had established why they went to level 3. That was fairly well understood. But the rapid downgrading of the situation was questioned by the media. They asked for the modeling. They asked for data, the internal data that the government would have had to allow them to make those decisions. And at that point, GMB refused to provide that data. And it's troubling that on February 14th, middle of the month, we have Trudeau invoking the Emergency Act. And 10 days later, Higgs and Jennifer Russell are on the final press conference, public press conference ever for COVID-19. And they announced that all protections, every protection, isolation, masking, gathering limits are going to be removed March 14th. And as you said, there's no possible way, knowing how government works and knowing the speed of bureaucracy, that those decisions were made in a timely manner following information that flowed out of the previous 2 or 3 or 4 weeks. There's no way whatsoever.
Not possible.
But you can see how the close proximity of those events, the Freedom Convoy and the removal of all mandates, could be construed in the public eye to be cause and effect. It's no wonder these things, the rhetoric of the Freedom Convoy, science denialism, misinformation, ends up in the public consciousness as truth, when in their perception, all the mandates that they'd been following for years evaporated immediately after the mistruths were spoken in the media.
The other, when you mentioned that February 24th final press conference, something that we have come to know after that is that the first BA2 Omicron subvariant case was sequenced in New Brunswick in early February. And that is something that public health at some level, you know, whether that's Dr. Russell, whether that's one of the regional medical officers of health, whether that's somebody in the Department of Health, they would have been well aware of that. That, you know, up to that point, we were dealing with BA1. And in early February, weeks before this press conference, the final press conference, where they announced that all the protections would be dropped, we had a brand new subvariant in the province, sequenced in the province. And this is with highly restricted testing. So January 5th, 2022, New Brunswick changed its testing. And that change persists today. Previous to January 5th, 2022, anybody with symptoms could go for a PCR. And because of the demand, it might take you a few days to get your appointment and a few more days to get your results. And they definitely had problems with that. And they never scaled up their PCR testing the way Nova Scotia did. Rapid tests and public rapid testing were fairly new to New Brunswick. And yet, January 5th, 2022, that's when the governor of New Brunswick just all of a sudden said, PCR is reserved for people who are 50 plus, unless you are pregnant, immunocompromised, or you're living or working in a congregate setting, like a shelter, or healthcare workers as well could still access PCR, or if you were under the age of 2, because rapid tests weren't for use by kids under the age of 2. So January 5th, New Brunswick, you know, really massively restricted PCR testing, especially for school-age children, right? All of a sudden, school-age children were excluded from access to PCR. And what that means in terms of watching for new variants, PCR tests are where you do your sampling for your variants. All of a sudden, they would have reduced their surveillance for new variants. And yet, despite that, despite massively restricting PCR tests, despite really restricting what we've now come to learn is the most infected portion of the population, which is children, they've completely removed their visibility on checking that population for variants. But despite all that, in early February, New Brunswick sequenced its first case of BA2. And so the people involved, people in power, knew that once again, we had a new subvariant. And despite knowing that, they actively chose to continue dropping the protections And like you said, February 24th, to announce preemptively, you know, far in advance of it happening, they announced, they had their final press briefing, and they announced the end of isolation and masking together, which, Chris, you might have something to say about the timing of the provinces choosing to drop which protections and when.
Yeah. So they announced on the 24th that that was going to happen. A few days later, Saskatchewan becomes the first province to remove their mask mandate. And actually, at the same time, they removed their isolation mandate. Most provinces kept isolation requirements in place for positive patients well into the year. We let them go when masks went in March, but Saskatchewan beat everybody to the punch with that late in February. I wanted to say, too, it's an important point of context to remember that subvariants weren't something in the public consciousness at this point. Omicron being a new variant after Delta was a big deal. The idea of subvariants and of reinfections was not something that was really present in the public consciousness. So at the end of February, we have a total of 66 more deaths added to the total. That was later revised to 90. But at the time, that left us at 304 New Brunswickers dead from COVID-19. We get into March, and it becomes a pretty trendy nationally for provinces to get rid of masks. We see Alberta lifting its mask mandate on the beginning of the month. BC removed theirs about 2 weeks later. Newfoundland removed theirs the same time we did. We removed all protections, as we previously mentioned, on March 14th. Manitoba lifts their mask and isolation mandate, similar to ourselves. Yukon, Nova Scotia, and Ontario all lift their mask mandates at some point in March. March is a big month for getting rid of protections to people.
Despite the fact that a number of these provinces dropped their mask mandates in March, in the Atlantic provinces, New Brunswick was the only one that dropped them in schools at the same time as in the general public. PEI, and actually Quebec as well, beyond Atlantic Canada. Well, Quebec hadn't dropped their masks yet at that point. And so Quebec had the masks in school and in public, despite the fact that in Nova Scotia and in Newfoundland, generally there was no longer a mask mandate. Newfoundland kept the universal mask requirement in school. And they decided actually pretty early on that in Newfoundland, they take a longer break at Easter. They don't do a spring break, a reading week at the same time as the rest of us. They do their week-long break coincided with Easter. So they had already announced to their public in Newfoundland that school masks were going to be required until the Easter break, which was actually in like mid-April due to the timing of Easter. So even though masks were dropped for the public in Newfoundland, there was still a universal school mask requirement until later in April. In Nova Scotia, the IWK's pandemic response group wrote an open letter during Nova Scotia's March break addressed to Dr. Strang and to the premier. So Dr. Strang, the chief public health officer, imploring them to keep school masks. And so Nova Scotia did, at the very last minute, keep universal masks in school for another few weeks beyond when they were returning from March break. And PEI hadn't dropped masks yet. So it actually ended up being that New Brunswick children were the only children east of Ontario who didn't get to have universal mask protection in schools through the very difficult month of March 2022 and into April, when the other provinces also did keep their universal protections in schools, despite the fact that Newfoundland and Nova Scotia had dropped them for the general public.
Yeah. Continuing to show their disregard for schools, early in the month, prior to the 14th, when all protections were removed, including masking in schools for New Brunswick, the government came out and announced that they're also going to stop tracking cases in schools. We had seen that in our review of the data that was coming out of the government and out of the education system, that schools were a primary driver of infection. Retrospectively, now we know that they are the vast majority of infection vectors for most situations. So that was an unfortunate situation that also occurred with them removing all that data. And it would signal early on what was going to be coming out for the general province-wide data that was going to be changed bit by bit over the course of the month and the year.
So in March, we saw the removal of many protections in place with no evidence or data to justify any of it.
Yeah, two things that really I want to really put a fine point on. are the move from public health towards personal risk assessment and the individualization of a pandemic response. At the time, because people were confused by this change, this rapid change that they saw between the middle of February and the beginning of March, the narrative became one of putting the onus back on people to make their own risk assessment and to manage things as they saw fit. They were quick to suggest at that time that if the situation changed and that public health officials determined that a new approach was going to be necessary, they would make new recommendations to the provincial government. They always put that in there. If something changed, they would change their recommendations to government. We know now that that has never happened, regardless of any change that we've seen. We've seen four additional waves of Omicron go through the country since that initial wave that caused protections to be put in place, and nothing has been done. No word from public health for a recommendation to the government.
They don't even address us anymore. They don't even communicate with us anymore. Not only do they not reinstate mask mandates, not only do they not reinstate any kind of protections, they don't even communicate. They don't even tell us. They don't even warn us.
I'm sitting here with this giant furrowed brow, and I'm just kind of have my head in my hands because I'm remembering in March how when these protections were lifted, and like for myself, living with different medical vulnerabilities, and for other people in my life who do as well, we watched the government open things up across the country. And then another faucet as well was seeing people we cared about and loved ones and people who are involved in businesses and organizations and community all of a sudden say, we are following the public health measures and promoting and organizing large group unmasked events because now they could. And, but they weren't safe for everyone. They weren't inclusive for everyone. And I remember just watching, being completely aghast. And like a month ago, this would have never been possible. And yet now you're saying, quote unquote, we're following all public health measures. That's not how disease works. Oh my goodness.
It became a get out of jail free card because being forced to follow public health measures for 2 years, now they could say that knowing full well that there were no public health measures. So public health measures was just a renaming of we can do whatever we want.
Yeah.
It was very unexpected for me where, and I know for others as well, seeing people we cared about not care for us, expose themselves to disease, and then try to expose us to disease because they're following all public health measures.
Right. It's that approval, right? It's that, yeah. It's that makes it seem like it's sanctioned. It's so insidious. And I think that what's tough for New Brunswick, and I think that people that are listening from other areas of Canada don't have that same experience, is that in New Brunswick, for the beginning of the pandemic, our government was actually pretty reactive to the situation on the ground. And this is tough because they never acknowledged airborne transmission. They were never doing the actually most effective things to stop transmission. But they were for a long time willing to use the most basic tool, which was reducing contact. Now we know, looking back, we know now that all those times that contacts were reduced, because we weren't also using that time to really educate on vaccination, to improve indoor air quality, to educate people on N95s, on respirators, we weren't really gaining that much ground, but we did save lives and misery by taking the steps that were taken. And what I'm referring to there is when a zone had a jump in hospitalizations, the government would put in temporary restrictions in that zone, including, you know, you weren't supposed to travel in and out of certain zones at certain times. Indoor dining and in-person school would have been closed for certain zones at certain times. Like there was a lot of responsiveness in New Brunswick early on And I think that people ended up really trusting the government to use the tools to respond to the situation on the ground when it was warranted, right? Because that's what we saw happen for the first 15 or so months of the pandemic. And so that's, I think, what something that's uniquely tough in New Brunswick is that because in the beginning, depending on the way the situation on the ground changed, the protections also changed. And so for all of a sudden, the government to say, oh, no protections are needed anymore. And like you're saying, Cheryl, we're following public health by being wide open and having no protections. People for 15 plus months felt protected by the government response because it did seem to come and go based on the hospitalizations, based on the spread. And yet all of a sudden, that was no longer the case. But that was never announced. They probably felt they couldn't say, by the way, this is not backed up by evidence, but we're dropping everything, right? And yet, because they did respond to the situation for so many months, I think a lot of people got lulled into, you know, the situation that Chris mentions frequently, which is the government's response shows you whether or not the hazard exists, right? And so when they are no longer signaling that there is a hazard, because they've dropped all the protections, so many people don't feel that they need to take even their own protections, even the voluntary ones, because they have felt that, well, if having the World Juniors was dangerous, surely the government wouldn't do it. But that's not true. So, but they've never explicitly said that. People really like to trust that somebody is making the right call for us and somebody is making good decisions. And we've seen time and time again that that's not true. But a lot of the biggest stuff that we've uncovered is not stuff that the media wants to do a lot of stuff on. Mm-hmm.
It's so true. And following on in that thread where we see the government and public health kind of adopt some of the language or the sentiment of the Freedom Convoy is really present in this month. We see them move from trying to sell the public on mandated protections to trying to sell them on the idea of personal responsibility. We see them say, it's up to you now. You have to make your own assessment. At the exact same time that they go from daily updates to weekly updates for the data, at the exact same time when they go from, you know, a public press conference every few days to never having a public press conference again. It's like rebranding abandonment as this ethical and moral reinstatement of personal autonomy. You know, it's like we hear you. Freedom means everything. We're going to be the good guys. And that's why we're doing nothing. And to your point, Kay, with the history that we experienced in New Brunswick, with the government actually doing a fairly decent job of communicating, or at least trying, keeping up with the science and trying to get that out into the public sphere, while public health was regularly updating the public, we saw a fairly high level of comprehension. People understood how things were working, what things meant. They understood why certain protections were being put in place, and they expected them because they saw the data and they could see where that was pointing. Even when the data was incomplete or, let's face it, in some cases misleading, the public discourse was evolved enough to at least understand the intricacies of the science as it was evolving. What we saw come out of this big change in March initially was confusion, right? The confusion that followed the removal of all of the mandated protections really kind of hung in the air for a month or so. And it, just like you said, and it's something that I talk about a lot, the absence of protections and those associated downstream inference that there's nothing to be protected against kind of did the rest of the work for the government. If we look at the numbers, for example, for vaccination, we see that following the removal of the mandated protections and the cessation of all the public press conferences, vaccination rates stall. They just stop. Following that, we've had 2 5-month periods where people should be, you know, uptaking with boosters and stuff, and none of that has happened. And as people became more kind of comfortably unaware, their incentive to protect themselves diminishes. And in the absence of information updates, the public developed a narrative that the pandemic was over. And this was helped a lot by Higgs coming into the media soon afterwards and comparing COVID to a common cold. He came out around this time, actually it was early April, and he said that we're all going to get COVID, which is really a candid admission of failure for the government. This is not something that is a fact. It's not something that is a foregone conclusion, but it was in a lot of ways his way of saying that we've given up, we've failed, we're not going to do anything. And then we move into this framing of people who are still interested in protecting themselves as being neurotic or anxious, or, you know, it becomes a psychological ailment for people to have some interest in maintaining protections of themselves. And I think where I end up is that we can plainly see the amount of concerted effort that's being applied to this task of changing people's minds and people's perceptions. They worked for 2 years to educate about the pandemic, and they've gone in this completely different direction to now undo that education, to change what they've taught people, because it's no longer being helpful to what they're trying to do, trying to open up. They apply it to changing how data is represented, how it's interpreted. And I think it really speaks to an interest in manufacturing consent for these choices that they've made. We don't see this with other viruses. We don't see them changing the way they measure influenza cases or hospitalizations or deaths. This doesn't happen with other diseases that are in circulation. And it's so blatant that you have to ask yourself, why is this happening with COVID? Especially when it looks like all of those efforts universally trend toward exculpation of the government, right? Of justifying their actions when there's no information, no data, and no science to justify it.
So for listeners, essentially, what happened nationally and also provincially was the setting up in January, February, March of the foundations of the government completely exiting pandemic protocols, pandemic surveillance, pandemic involvement, and just leaving it up to all of us to navigate this. And how has that ended up? Well, not good, not good. We saw the government set up these foundations to exit the room, and it has had very, very bad consequences. I've known people personally, I've met more people who have lost loved ones because of COVID. I have met people and know people who are now living with long COVID symptoms. And this is just, I am just one person. There are so many people who are living the effects. For those who are living, they are living the effects of government abandonment. And they are also living without any financial relief that also ended in the spring of 2022, there were several federal government programs that ended as well in this time. We focused a lot on the spring because that's really what sets us up and brings us to this point right now, starting 2023, of complete you do you approach to public health.
So one other thing that I would add is that early on in March, after the announcement of the removal of all protections, but before the March 14th date when they did actually get removed, particularly in schools, we saw, I guess, what could be considered the formal start of PopNB with the petition to reinstitute mask mandates in schools. This was later on in the month, on the 25th, delivered and presented to the legislature. It wasn't ultimately successful, but it really did galvanize us as a group to keep advocating in these fields. So at the end of March, we saw an additional 45 deaths reported. This was later revised to 71, but at the time, it left us just shy of 350 deaths, 349 at the end of March. We'll come back and talk about how those deaths have since changed. But yeah, that's where we saw ourselves in March. Really no slowing of the amount of people succumbing to COVID-19.
Yeah. And that's, I know for listeners, it's a bleak spot to leave off, but I suppose you probably have a hunch that this is a bleak topic because you're listening to a pandemic podcast. But at the same time, I hope that you find some normalcy in knowing that there's other folks thinking these things, there's other folks sharing these things, and there's other folks acknowledging that a pandemic exists, which sounds absolutely ridiculous saying that out loud, but it's true in this current landscape. For our next episode, we are going to be finishing up our year in review of 2022. There was quite a bit going on, as you can tell, and I hope that part one has been very informative. And also for folks listening, if you are interested, we would greatly appreciate if you can subscribe to our channel and if you can leave a review, because reviews help bring more folks to the show. And then we also get an idea of what you think of it. I'm going to do a shout out to one of our listeners who left a review, which we so much appreciate. Let's see. Our listener shared, "I am enjoying this podcast. While many have moved on, those who continue to understand the risks of a still pretty novel pathogen will feel both validated by the hosts and their knowledge, and their resolve to continue using the precautionary principle will be reinforced." Thank you so much. We appreciate it so much. So if you're available, we greatly appreciate reviews and subscriptions. And then that also helps bring more folks to the show and let them know that, hey, we're still living in a pandemic and we're still going to keep talking about it. So thank you so much for sharing your time with us, and we'll talk to you next time.